You are listening to the sassiest podcast in the world. Born in the Nordics, democratizing B2B SaaS knowledge everywhere.
Hi, I'm Daniel.
And I'm Thomas, and we are experienced SaaS professionals that are curious about how other successful SaaS companies go to market, scale, build winning teams, and great products.
Join us on our journey as we speak to SaaS leaders trying to get hold of their secret sauce.
And today's guest is Martin Lidgaard, the co-founder and CEO of WebManuals.
Make sure that people have a steady salary and that the motivation doesn't come from money, but it comes from being part of a team that's performing well together. And that means that we have to get everyone up to speed and then perform well together. That's our responsibility.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Sassiest Podcast. And today I'm here with my good friend, Daniel. How nice it is to do another podcast with you. And how are you? Do you miss me?
I miss you a lot. Luckily, I get to see you, like, obviously virtually, and we spend quite some time. You're in my ears all the time, yeah. Which makes me, you know, feel some kind of comfort. But like, I'm really looking forward to spending a lot more time together. And obviously the event Sassiest is coming up, and we're going to be spending time together with 1,200 other people here in April. So that will be a lot of fun.
Absolutely. I've had the opportunity to work from Thailand here for a couple of weeks, but yeah, nothing like home, spending time with a lot of monitors and the full studio gear. So, but today, we're going to talk to an entrepreneur that has made a fantastic journey and has a company that are doing a lot right, I think, when it comes to how they manage their people, giving young people opportunities and all of that. So I think if you want to know more about it, you should catch on. Did we do enough promotion for Sassiest? Maybe you should say something else about it.
I mean, just very quickly, so this one is a feel-good story here with Martin. You need to tune into this one. It will inspire you today. And when it comes to Sassiest, you guys know the drill by now. April 16th and 17th, 1,200 people, operators. We only dedicate 10% of the tickets to non-operators, meaning, you know, the ecosystem, investors, recruiters, and so on. What you need to know is that you obviously will have access to the event app before, because one big part of the exercise here is for you to connect with your peers.
Yeah.
So depending on when you're listening to this, make sure you get your game on, make sure you connect with people already prior to the event, make sure you sign up for the social activities on day zero, meaning April 15th. There are some boat cruises, there's paddle tournaments. All these things will help you have an even better experience when you show up there on the 16th. So connect with your peers. And of course, also try to make a plan for which sessions. We hope you want to see all sessions, of course, but make a plan for what particularly you want to see, because you know how we do this now. We put people on stage that share tactical hands-on advice. We ask everybody to show and share the 5 steps to do XYZ, the 3 steps to do ABC, whatever that is. Get your pen and paper ready, get your phone ready, and make sure you tune in to learn something, because I promise you, and if my promise is not correct, you can come back to me and I will eat my shoe. I promise you, you will go home a little bit wiser, a little bit more inspired, with a Rolodex of new contacts that will really propel your personal professional career. So
yeah,
come and join us and we'll have lots of fun.
Absolutely.
How was that for promotion, Thomas?
It was good. We were sold out last year, so I hope you don't wait too long. Really want to meet you there, especially since you're listening to the podcast. And now let's go on for the interview today. Today we are super excited to have Martin Lidgaard, the co-founder and CEO of WebManuals, here as guest in the Sassiest podcast. So warm welcome to you, Martin.
Thank you, Thomas.
Welcome on board. And the funny thing is, like, obviously you guys don't see this now if you're listening to this, but just a moment ago, they were both singing in their microphones and now they're all like sitting straight up and being like super professional. So let's see if I can lure back the song here in a few moments. But before we get there, Martin, for the people and folks that might not know you, who is Martin?
It's funny that you asked that, because that's exactly the first question I do in all my final interviews with candidates. And it always stumps people.
Not who is Martin, right?
Exactly. No. Who is X?
Okay, yeah.
Although it would be cool to ask them, like, who is Martin?
I think I would probably lose the very best people with that particular question.
Okay.
As long as you don't speak about yourself in third person, hey, Martin is entering the room, Martin will join the meeting soon, you're all cool.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I might get to that at some point. But no, so I'm a Swede, grown up in California and in Belgium, married with three kids, living here in southern Sweden. And other than that, I love different types of outdoor activities, playing music, building Legos with the kids. And on the business side, I'm a four-time bootstrapping entrepreneur.
All right. So was this always your dream, driving your own business?
No, this was an act of desperation.
Okay. Tell us more.
Well, I was having a lot of fun studying in Lund. CSN, so the Swedish funding for students, they didn't really agree with my exam results. And as a result, they pulled the plug on my financing. And I had to survive and pay the rent somehow. So I got started with some consulting, and then one thing led to another.
You walk in the shoes of many great IT entrepreneurs.
Starting off with a solid failure, setting us up for continuous improvement from that point.
Yeah, and now you're the CEO of Web Manuals. And I mean, you're working with documentation for the aviation industry. And I mean, how do you come up with that? What was the journey until you came to Web Manuals?
Well, if you want to spend the whole podcast on that topic, I can definitely fill that journey. But in short, the company before Web Manuals was doing a general web content management and e-commerce solution. And one of our customers was a small airline in Gothenburg, and they asked us if we could help them distribute manuals for their pilots and crew. And we had some of the technology in place to do that. It was fairly straightforward. When I came back, once we delivered that project, which was a fairly small, 150 hours of consulting, I came back to Gothenburg, and they were super happy. They told me that they had saved two full-time positions and like £1 million per year compared to doing the printing and publishing and distribution.
That's when you realize you undercharge.
Exactly. That's exactly what. And on the way back, my sales manager and I would discuss this. Wow, this, we could really do something big out of this. We could sell this to all the airlines of the world. And it was like one of those great ideas that you never follow through on.
How long ago was this?
This was 17 years ago.
17.
So this is 2007.
Wow.
And then as it happened, our contact at that airline was married to the marketing manager of another airline just across the hallway from them. So of course it didn't take long before they reached out and said, "Hey, well, could we work with you as well?" And by that time I realized that I was undercharging, and that was probably the fourth or fifth time that I had undercharged for projects. So I came back strong and said, "Well, we're doing a per user per month." And they're like, well, it seems a little bit expensive, but if you can give us a discount, then we'll go for it. So that was essentially the starting point. It's been a journey of working together with customers and really involving them in the innovation process. And it's taken us to where we are now.
So how long did it take you for actually having a sort of packaged product that was easy to scale and not sort of a one-off consultant project?
Well, I think the distribution product was very simple. In its core, it's a very simple solution. So that was more or less scalable, packageable from the second or third project. But we got ourselves into the authoring, so writing manuals and using our content management system. And that was more of a journey. It probably took us 2 or 3 years of own investments in building that product before it was something that fulfilled at least the sort of minimum viable product. So what we originally estimated for that project was maybe 300 hours, and it came out at maybe 5,000 hours.
Wow.
Without any external funding. So that was pretty tough, and that's pretty much killed that investment, more or less killed that company. And what happened was we then sold off that business and then spun off this authoring, manual authoring business into a new company, and used the little bit of funding, just enough to survive the first year, to start up Web Manuals in 2012.
All right. So just fast forwarding to now, what can you say about the company or the product that you're offering? Is it still for the airlines? What kind of capabilities do you have in your platform?
Yeah. So there's essentially three components that it's all built around. It's the authoring of manuals, it's the distribution of manuals, and it's linking to regulation databases with aviation regulations so that you can prove that the procedures that you have in your manuals are actually compliant with regulations. So those are the sort of the content, the distribution, and the compliance are the three pillars. We still target aviation 100%, perhaps a slightly broader sense than before. I mean, we originally worked with just airlines, but business aviation is maybe a third of our revenue. And then we have a third, which is all other types of aviation organizations, such as maintenance, airports, air traffic control, ground handling, even authorities. So that it's broadened quite a bit, but still within the aviation space.
All right. And is there a particular size of these aviation companies, or do you take all sizes?
The strategy has been to focus on small to mid-sized. So we've been really focusing on having a disruptive position and, you know, finding a slot which was not occupied by competitors. And that's been true for the first 10 years. And then the last 2 years, we've been getting more requests and actually wins of enterprise, sort of tier one airlines. And that's where we're now refining our approach to be able to be successful in winning some of the largest airlines of the world. But the core of the business is still sort of the SMB.
Right.
Okay. So who's your brag customer?
Brag customer.
Yeah.
There are a number of, I would say we have quite a lot of Fortune 500 companies in the U.S.
Okay.
That I can't mention.
American Airlines, Delta.
No, it's sort of their corporate flight departments.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's the companies that you don't expect to have anything to do with aviation, but they have a flight department and, you know, a couple of jet aircraft and top secret. But in terms of airlines, KLM, Cathay Pacific, DHL. So some of the really biggest ones out there.
Nice.
Cool.
I have to ask, Martin, like, you know, a lot of people say, especially investors out there, now you're a bootstrap, so you're probably giving them the middle finger. Sorry, I didn't say that loud. But
I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't even bother with doing that.
No, sometimes, you know, like, you know, one of the concerns or worries people have, like, is your addressable market big enough? Hmm. And I'm listening to you here. I have to ask, like, you know, like, how big is the aviation space? I guess my question is, like, will it at some point be like you're done with it and you have to go into another industry as well? I don't know, whatever that would be, like healthcare or something.
Well, I can say it's not big enough for a product-led growth, freemium kind of model. It's not that big. Mm-hmm. It's big enough for us to grow to maybe 10 or 20 times our current size just within aviation.
Okay.
So yeah, so there's plenty of work to do.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the numbers now since you lured us in there a little bit. Like, where are you guys right now in terms of ARR? And we'd also like to know, like, you know, how fast are you guys growing year over year here?
Yeah. So we just passed 10 million euros in ARR.
Yay.
And so that's a nice metric and puts us in
congratulations.
A new league. So thank you. And last year we had a growth of 45% in net revenue.
Nice.
So which is quite nice. With a slim profitability.
Okay. These are numbers that many people would be jealous over. So tell us a little bit, the 10 million mark here when you crossed it, like how many customers do you have on board right now?
So just over 600.
600. And I'm imagining now, I know one should not do assumptions, but are they based all over the world? Are there certain geos that you focus more on?
Not focus more on, but where we're more present and more successful.
Yeah.
So we have customers in about 90 different markets, so almost half of the countries of the world. And we have offices in Malmö, San Diego, New York, Singapore, and Sydney. So we're trying to see where there's a good opportunity and to build up a presence locally to make sure that we can have those close relationships with customers.
Yeah, I've seen that the pictures and videos online, and if I would be younger and looking for a real job, you'd have my application on on your desk. So how many are you full-time employees today to support this operation?
About 80.
About 80? Yeah. Okay, that's less than I was expecting. That's a good number to support the 10 million mark. Okay. Yeah. And obviously, it's a bootstrap exercise. You've never raised money. It's all own pocket from your student loan and up to this point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to take into consideration that the product was originally developed in the previous company. So
yeah,
that was a mix of consulting and licenses that funded that development. So we had a working product, not a mature or complete, but a sellable product when we started in 2012.
Yeah,
we had 8 customers, and we were 5 working co-founders, and that we had enough cash from the sale of the previous company to allow us to sell and finance the first year.
Yeah. And how big of an ownership do you personally have? Is it evenly split among the co-founders or?
No, 3 of the co-founders decided to jump ship after the first year. And since then, there's been a further consolidation. So I currently own 95% of the company.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. I think thank you so much for sharing those numbers. I'm a little bit, I didn't know it was that strong. Let's put it that way. I knew you guys were doing really well, but 45% growth and 10 million.
You're working a little bit, all of these VC-funded companies, they get a lot of the headlines, but I mean, you have really been able to build a solid company here out of the Nordics with a great future, it sounds. Really excited to have you here and dive a little bit more into how you work. And I mean, you have this global approach, and we know that you're also hiring quite many young people and so on. And how did you think about this from the start with the global? Did you always think that, we need to move out of our Malmo office? How did you decide who should we send to Singapore or the US? Can you tell us a little bit about that strategy from the get-go?
Well, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. If you look at aviation in Sweden, maybe there are about 30 air operators, so airlines, business jet, and helicopter operators in Sweden in total. So it was quite quick to realize that if we're going to focus just on Sweden, we'll sort of tap out at about 2 million crowns in revenue as a max. So that there was a realization that if we're going to do this, and as I said, it was an act of desperation, we didn't have too many options, then we have to go globally. So already after the first 2 years of operation, we established the U.S. entity. Already in year 4, we hired our first U.S. employee. Already year 6, I moved to New York to start up our second U.S. Office. I mean, the U.S. has the biggest single aviation market,
yeah.
So we knew that we had to get in there, and we wanted to do that as early as possible.
Yeah.
All right.
So I want to ask you a little bit what Thomas said here, that I know you're an equal opportunity employer, you look for the best talent and so on, but also one cannot get away from the fact that you have been particularly generous in giving young professional an opportunity and sometimes, as an outsider, rather big responsibilities.
Yeah.
Like, tell us about that mindset and how you weigh, sometimes maybe the inexperience with the energy versus the risk associated with that.
Well, I think it's once again, it's the bootstrapper's dilemma there, that you really need all the experience you can get, but can only pay for, zero experience, essentially. So we've had to figure out how to make that work by being quick in getting new team members onboarded. And we have a whole boot camp, like a 2-week boot camp training session where they learn everything about the industry, about the product, the company, the strategy, and so on. And then that continues with role-specific onboarding. And we've really taken that to the max. I mean, at the end of the bootcamp training, you have a 100-question test.
Wow.
Where you need a fairly high passing grade.
What happens if you don't pass the test? I mean, you get 55 out of 100. What happens?
Well, you get an uncomfortable conversation with me or someone else on the management team to understand where things went wrong. What is it? Was it a problem in the way that we provided the training? Was it a problem in the amount of time you had to prepare? Or was it an issue in terms of motivation or interest and so on? As long as there's still a commitment to stay with the team, we'll do everything we can to get that person up to speed.
Okay.
But we'd rather identify that problem as early as possible in order to get them up to speed and be as productive and satisfied as possible. So we want to get that happening as early as possible. Because, I mean, at some point, my theory is, if you don't provide any onboarding, people will eventually be, you know, more or less fully onboarded, but it's probably going to take a year or two.
Yeah.
And during that time, a lot of people will be frustrated, and the effort of getting them onboarded is lower if we concentrate this and can even do it in groups. So we onboard, you know, 5 or 10 people at a time.
So do they get to do the test again if they fail?
No. We look at the test results, and then we can go through and identify where the problem is and what needs to be sorted out.
Okay. So,
But the test is only a small thing, but it adds a sense of commitment and urgency from the team member and from the instructors doing these 60 hours of classroom training. Mm. That you know, this is serious. It's not just a you know, 2 week holiday.
Right.
You're here to very clearly learn something and get up to speed. And the funny thing is, we do these boot camps typically every 3 months, and that means that the boot camp instructors may very well have been onboarded just 3 months earlier.
Okay.
So it's often that you move very quickly from being the student to being the teacher.
Yeah.
Which, as you know, is a great way of sort of confirming your knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, it's I'm going to come back to that. Just a funny story here. Thomas just wants you, Martin, to get the whip out and say, like, you know, this is what happens if you don't pass. I think it's very important what you say. Like, no names mentioned. If you're listening to this, you know I still love you. But just like you said, you know, you fly people in. It's a big commitment. It's not a 2 week of vacation. I've had one scenario where a new sales team came in, young professionals, really excited. First day, lots of energy. First evening, go out and get hammered in a local bar, lose their laptop, lose their phone. Come back late the second day. It's like you're not off to a good start.
Yeah.
You're not. It turned out that this gentleman did really well for the company for many years, but he was off to a shaky start, and he had to realize the hard way that this is no vacation, so to say. Yeah. What I wanted to ask you a little bit is, and you answered that to some extent, do you have a dedicated onboarding / continuous enablement team? Is there somebody that's responsible all the time, saying like, Josh or Anna, you're responsible for making sure people progress all the time here?
So, I mean, we have our employee experience team.
Yeah.
And they work with that. They work with developing our leaders' capabilities to support our team members. Some teams do have that type of specific role. So our sales enablement function has that role to sort of drive the development of the sales team. But for others, it's part of the continuous development within the organization.
Yeah.
So we do invest a lot in that type of continuous development. And it's in boot camp is one thing, and sort of the onboarding that happens directly after that. But also in the ongoing weekly one-on-one conversations, there's internal mentorship programs. There might be external mentorship programs. We have an exchange program where we have candidates spending 2 or 3 weeks at other offices to really dive into the deep end of how business is done somewhere else in the world.
So let me ask you this, Martin. I'm curious, have you noticed a particular difference, or are there certain areas you need to emphasize? Because when you hire, call it a seasoned professional, somebody that has been in, you know, doing sales, let's say, for 20 years. Often then the onboarding is like he or she needs to learn our offerings, the USP, some knowledge about the customers, but we don't have to teach that person about how to sell particularly. Like when you onboard young people that maybe have not that much experience in either the sales job or whatever it is, the marketing job, and so, do you also educate them and enable them in the specific craftsmanship of the role as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, I mean, the foundation there is, I mean, we work with manuals for aviation. So, of course, we have to adopt that same mindset ourselves.
Right.
So, we have all these manuals describing the processes, how we organize ourselves, the playbooks for the sales team. And so the different departments go really in on the deep end in terms of making sure that everyone, regardless of prior experience, is fully onboarded with how we work. And I know the sales team, they have weekly sessions where they practice selling to each other and having different role plays and so on. So then there's a lot of activity there to really get people to very quickly be successful. And that's the thing about being bootstrapped. There's no margin for error. I mean, we are trying to have the same level of rule of 40 growth. And in order to be able to do that, you have to be very mindful of how you spend your resources. So there's no room for having salespeople not performing. We need to get them up to speed as quickly as possible. I mean, there's a completely different topic for us to have on the topic of not having any sales commission, but that's been our choice philosophy, is to make sure that people have a steady salary and that the motivation doesn't come from money, but it comes from being part of a team that's performing well together.
Right.
And that means that we have to get everyone up to speed and perform well together. That's our responsibility.
Absolutely. And I mean, you have mentioned how you sort of do this from the get-go, from the start. You make sure that everyone gets a good onboarding and so on. But how do you sort of maintain this over time? Because you can't fly in everyone every third month from all the offices, right? So how do you maintain it?
Not every third, but every 6 months you can do it.
Okay. And you do that.
And we do that. So we have two annual kickoffs. So summer kickoff is in Sweden, and the winter kickoff is, when I get my way, it's in the Alps for skiing.
Okay.
And when my co-founder Richard, who's our CTO, when he gets his way, it's somewhere as warm as possible, but still, you know, practical to travel to.
Okay. So how often do you get your way?
Yeah, that's every second winter.
Okay.
It's very frustrating. we spent a week in Barcelona with the whole team just a month ago. So people fly in from Australia, from Singapore, San Diego, New York, and we spend a good number of days together, have fun. One day is focused on strategy and strategic development, and one day is spent on culture and core values and that sort of, the topic was self-leadership this year. So really focusing on that.
Martin, how much does this cost you, this exercise, a trip to Barcelona? How much does that set you back?
Well, let's say that we spend about 5% of our annual revenue on kickoffs, boot camps, leadership development, different types of mentorship programs, exchange programs. So about 5% is focused on the employee experience as a whole and trying to build that team.
I'm going to pull up my phone. So that's 500K, right?
Yeah.
Split over how many employees did you say? 80? So it's a decent chunk per employee that you commit here. And when you meet at these boot camps and so on, you have the programs and you do these things that you just mentioned, like how do you follow up that, like what keeps motivating you that this is a good investment? How do you know that, okay, the pace of doing this twice a year, as an example, is a good investment? If we would go down to just once a year, we'd lose some traction.
Yeah.
Or why not go three times a year?
Yeah. Well, I think that the proof is in the pudding. So averaging 43% growth over 12 years. I think that's pretty solid proof that something is working.
Right.
Yeah.
For me, I mean, there is such an energy in the team the months after kickoff that, you know, I would love to do it every, you know, four times a year. But yeah, we also need to earn some money and you know, deliver some value to customers. So we can't just do that. But you have to remember that on top of this, you have a lot of other things that happen that energize a team. We have three annual user conferences, one in Sweden, San Diego, and in Singapore, that are energy boosters for the local teams working with the customers in that region. We have other you know, conferences and trade shows that we travel to. A lot of the team members travel to meet with customers, you know, other, you know, fun activities together, of course.
Yeah.
And we had after the pandemic, we had this need to sort of reunite and re-energize. So we did this one-time thing, or at least a first-time thing, which was a world tour, where everyone on the team, regardless of role, traveled to meet customers. So we met with 70 customers in 17 countries during a week. And then we had, that was sort of the starting point of redefining our customer journey. But that's sort of getting everyone involved in the same thing and you know, sharing those experiences, that was a super, super cool energy booster.
Yeah. Anything new?
Yeah, I've been thinking. Do you know what capital as a service is?
Isn't that what Float offers?
Yes, it is. Think of it as CaaS for SaaS. You already understand how software works. It's easy, simple, and flexible. Just like most SaaS companies focus on user experience, Float brings the same digital experience in funding, where clients can customize their loans. It sounds impossible, right?
Yes! We are really entering a new era in funding. It sounds too good to be true. I also heard that even the loan contract can be read by a normal human. It doesn't require any guarantees or warrants. So exciting. I have to check it out on their website if this is for real at gofloat.io.
And you have also mentioned that every team member gets to be part of a yearly strategic project. So could you elaborate a little bit on that?
I mean, if you're growing at this rate, you always need to be reinventing the business and what you're doing and how you do it. So for the last, well, essentially since the very beginning, we've had these strategic projects that could be something as simple as introducing new software for internal use of whatever, or it could be developing a process or developing a completely new function in the company. Over the years, I think we've done well over 200 of these projects, and I'd say 90% of them have delivered success and value. And the approach here is that we'd rather have a new team member head up that project, and for them to be the project manager and to drive that initiative than to have someone as senior as possible. Of course, if you have someone as senior as possible, you might have an even higher hit rate.
Right.
But by engaging the junior team members, we're giving them a massive growth opportunity. We're challenging them, and we're making them feel important as a part of the team, that they're not just a little hang around that's is waiting around in the corridor until it's their time to shine. We're giving them the spotlight front and center from the very beginning.
All right.
And this is something that we're very ambitious in terms of who we hire, but we're willing to take a bet and hire people without too much prior experience. But we try to give them that experience as early as possible, and that creates a commitment and involvement that I think is quite unbeatable.
Okay. I mean, 200 projects, it's massive.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there must have been quite many smaller projects, but also maybe some big. So could you give some more examples of what you have done over the years?
Yeah. So Paul, who is now our COO, he started straight out of school, studying finance in Lund. His project was to, when we hit about 30 or 40 customers, we were struggling with invoicing and managing these 40 customer accounts. And we're doing that in Excel and doing everything manually. So, and this was probably in 2014 maybe. So we started looking at the options. We couldn't really find anything other than some of the really big CRM tools. So it was like, okay, we're going to really combine, a huge CRM tool with a huge e-commerce tool with a huge ERP and try to integrate these systems and spend millions and millions of crowns trying to build something that's going to be very expensive to maintain and that's going to be still a very bad fit for our business. And Paul and our CTO came up with an idea that, hey, we all, in any case, will need a little server to manage our different servers and to monitor them. If we just add some database tables to this server with the customer name and contact person and some contract details, we could do this ourselves. And essentially, that project also introduced a new technology, which was really fresh, which was AngularJS. At the time, it was completely new. And that choice of technology sped up the development by a factor of 10 compared to what we had at the time. So within maybe 2 months of development, we had built our own SaaS business system, essentially, that now is still the core of our business and that manages invoicing for all these different subsidiaries and different currencies, different countries, and so on. So that was a huge bet at the time and something that has paid off exceptionally well. And also for Paul, because he's moved from, importing content into building up our customer experience function, building up our quality management system, and taking on the role as COO sometime later. So that's one shining example.
Yeah, and it's clear that, people obviously will grow and, step right into, if you give them a big assignment, people will grow. They grow with the responsibility. But I still have to ask, are these projects, is that the individual themselves then that they realize, in this case, Paul, I have an issue here, so let's run with it? Or is it maybe somebody else identifies there's a gap or an opportunity and then you or somebody else in the organization points at okay, Thomas, you had nothing to do with the inception of the idea, but you're going to run it now?
Yeah. So, that's what we did in Spain. And then it started off actually last August when we had the kickoff in Sweden, where we worked together in mixed teams and tried to identify what are the challenges and opportunities that we look at when we talk about the goals that we have for the coming years. And based on these challenges and opportunities, we define loosely, projects that are then sort of made a little bit more concrete in the different teams. So if there's a challenge relating to the customer journey, of course, the CX organization is starting to look at that.
Right.
And then we make this even more concrete and start to ask for volunteer project managers. And, it's a little bit of a mix and match, trying to figure out who do we think has a good opportunity to contribute and where there's a match with the topic at hand as well. So it's something where we want to get the initiative from the team members, and sometimes we need to, give people a little bit of a nudge as well to make them realize that, hey, there's actually an opportunity here for you.
Yeah. I mean, for this to work, to me, it sounds like, and tell me if I misunderstood this, but it sounds like you want to enable people, you want to empower people. It's a little bit of you're democratizing the decision power. Everybody should have an influence and an impact here.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think you said at some point, we also know that if we would put Daniel in this project, it would probably be done a little bit faster, maybe work, from the get-go, rather if we put Thomas on this project. I just had to do it, Thomas. Sorry.
Yeah. At the same time, we see a lot of potential in Thomas.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of untapped potential that we don't want to see lost here. So
I've heard from Paul Malmroos that at Verdane that you peak at 48. So that's where I'm right now. So.
No, and what I was saying, Martin, is that to me this sounds like you have a culture that is very accepting, very tolerant, and also there is room for errors and forgiveness.
Yeah.
So things will sometimes go south, but that's okay because we're in this together. And I guess that was a long way for me to ask, how do you create a culture like this where everybody feels that holy shit, it's a big project, but I'm going to run with it. And I know I have the, you know, the organization behind me, even if it's not maybe a home run from the get-go.
Yeah, I think you're actually onto something quite essential in our culture. We have sort of copied the aviation principle of a no-blame culture.
Yeah.
And it comes down to the fact that if you imagine there's some aviation accident or incident, the key thing is to not repeat it. And the best way to not repeat it is to have the people that were involved, even if they were culpable to a certain extent, actually be the ones that can share the experience of how it should be done instead. What were the mistakes made, and how do we make sure that we don't repeat those mistakes?
Right.
So there has to be a very high degree of trust between management and the team members that you're allowed to make mistakes. As long as it was an honest mistake, it was not intentional, then we want to make sure that we learn as much as possible from that mistake. So that type of high trust culture is something that we try to bring about in a number of different ways, but really setting it into the core of our company. And one of our core values is responsibility. And with that, there's a responsibility, there's accountability, which is sort of the flip side. When something has gone wrong, people have to feel that they can stand up and say, that was my fault. Let's figure out how we can avoid that happening again.
Right.
Yeah, so you have to build that trust. There has to be an honesty and transparency in terms of how you manage that. And if you don't, you can be sure that you know, mistakes will be remade, because no one is admitting that there was a mistake ever made. So how can you ever make that stop or stop it from happening again?
Yeah.
Right.
No, but I mean, you really have a lot of good things going on here with the onboarding process, taking care of the young talent, giving them responsibility, opportunities. You have the global growth and everything. But what has been the challenges, and sort of can you share some of the fuck ups that you have been experienced down the way here?
All right. Well, without doubt, the biggest challenge was in February, March 2020, when Trump shut down the traffic from Europe to the US.
Yeah.
I was living in New York with my family at the time, and within, you know, 2 days of that happening, I realized that I won't be able to be the CEO of this company and be based in New York if I can't travel back and forth to meet with the Swedish team. So already within 2 days of that, we decided to move back, and we moved back after 3 weeks. Had four sets of tickets for the family that were just, you know, flights were canceled, money was lost, and finally on the fifth try we were able to get back. And essentially, that first Monday after that announcement by Trump, I had a remote call with my management team just to let them know that, okay, we're now moving from business as usual into crisis mode. And everything we're doing can be completely wiped out. All this investment, all this time and effort is currently at risk of being lost. And it's not a small risk. I mean, what we saw was pretty much all our airline customers were down to 5% of their normal operations. And in that case, you know, there are no holy cows out there, you know, any invoice coming in will most likely just be thrown away until, you know, the airlines can survive. So we had to move into crisis mode right away and figure out what customer areas are going to be most exposed to this. How do we address that? How do we secure financial means to survive this worst case? How do we ensure that we maintain good relationships with customers? How can we be proactive? You know, how do we manage the organization when we're going through this crisis? And the interesting thing was, most people thought that the pandemic was only like a 2 or 3 month thing. You know, by summer it would have blown over, and it didn't. So it was something where we had to figure out how to handle that situation. So that was a lot of mistakes made in that, and there were a lot of also subsequent crises in this that hit us in terms of, you know, the great resignation and, yeah, working remotely and losing touch with your team members and so on. So yeah, that was I wouldn't say it was a royal fuck up, but I would say it was definitely the biggest single crisis.
Yeah, and congratulations for coming out on the other side. But I wonder, has there been any ideas along the way, the last 5, 6, 7 years, that you thought that this is a really good way of sort of managing the staff, or here is how we should organize? Maybe you had an idea to go on a 3-time kickoff and that didn't work out. Is there anything that you have learned that we did this, it didn't work out, so we don't do that anymore?
Well, we looked at product-led growth as a growth opportunity, but came to realize that our addressable market is too small to be able to have, 98% of the opportunities just thrown away. So that was quite a little bit of effort going into that. I mean, I think it's made us a stronger company and streamlined our operations and so on.
Yeah.
But it was clear that was not necessarily the right way to go.
No. So that was on the product side, but nothing on the operational or people side that you saw?
Well, I mean, we started off strong with the big failure in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Okay. When we started off 2012, we did a market analysis, and this was post-financial crisis in Europe. So we felt that the home market of Europe is probably not the one to invest in. The States and Asia are too far away. So we identified, well, it seems like there's a lot of money in the Middle East, and maybe we could actually go down there and sell the system to all these wealthy business jet operators. I think the realization came after maybe too slow, because I was down there every month, and in the end, I had sold 1.5 licenses to customers in the Middle East. And I think what we didn't really realize was, at the time, regulatory compliance wasn't a top priority for these operators. And we were selling something which didn't really have the right price point compared to the value that they were perceiving.
Okay.
So there was a lot of wasted effort in that. The funny thing was, in the meantime, actually, the European market really took off for us. And when we decided to shut down this Middle Eastern project, we felt that, hey, okay, so if Europe is working like in your own hometown and it's going well, then let's challenge ourselves. So that's when we started the U.S. business.
Okay.
But we would have been better off just focusing on Europe and not spending so much effort in the Middle East if we had realized some of the market mechanics. But I mean, that's very difficult that early.
Yeah. I mean, hey, if we would make all the decisions right, none of us would be sitting in this podcast, as pleasant as it is,
I'm happy to be here,
Yeah, exactly. And Thomas is halfway to paradise. He sits in Thailand here, Martin, where you and I are in, I guess, the tropical parts of Sweden. So I want to come back a little bit to try to wrap things up and maybe also put things a little bit, on its edge. You're investing a lot in your people. Your people tend to be, younger professionals, a little bit earlier in their career. What we hear, and I must say we've also seen ourselves, some of the challenges that are sometimes unique to young people is that they're in the beginning of their career, so they're expecting a quick career trajectory. There is a path to something else, like every 1 year, 2 years, I need to jump to something. How do you handle that?
Well, what we've done is to, after many, many rounds of looking at this, say that, in actual fact, we have 3 different career paths. So one is the obvious one, leadership, moving into a manager position. But there are 2 other that are equally important. One is to move into process leadership. So not necessarily leading people, but to lead processes. And that becomes really important when we're a global company and we're trying to work as one team around the world. Then having those processes and driving that process leadership is important.
Right.
And the third one is, of course, more the subject matter expertise, being the expert in the product or being the expert in the specific aviation topic.
Right.
And trying to recognize those, both with title and with of course, salary.
So do you show these three plans, or I guess I call it career paths, already from the get-go to, like, you know, young hires and be like, this is what we hired you for, but here is how you can excel in this organization. You can go 1, 2, or 3, and this is what is required for you to go either way.
Yeah, so we introduced that as a part of the onboarding, the boot camp. Mm-hmm. And it's also something that's been worked on for quite some time, trying to refine how that works. And I actually presented the most recent version of that just a week ago at the last monthly meeting. So it's something that's a continuous improvement in that respect as well, and trying to hone in how that will work and how that will slot into a growing global organization.
Yeah. So you're spending a lot of time and energy and love. We like that. You know, like, hats off to you, because we believe that, you know, process, product, all those things are important. At the end of the day, it's the people that move the needle.
Yeah.
With all this investment, can you give us the concrete number? What is your non-voluntary churn, meaning people that leave web manuals that you don't want to leave? What is that percentage?
Churn last year was maybe 12%. And I'd say maybe 2/3 of that are non-voluntary.
Okay, so that's 8%. Yeah, good number.
Yeah,
something like that.
So, looking forward a little bit here. So, web manuals, the next 2 or 3 years, what can we expect?
So, in the next 4 years, we're looking to open up another 4 international offices. We're aiming to grow to about 500 million Swedish crowns by the end of 2027.
Which is about, like, with our currency today, let's just make it easy for us, about 50 million euros.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
What we decided is that once we hit 10 million in ARR, that was, for me at least, a personal milestone. That was, you know, it's quite a distinction in that sense. But we also realized that just aiming for the next number is not that exciting. So we're trying to figure out what's an exciting company to work for. And we said, well, we want to be a company that is present in all the areas where we have customers, which is essentially all the continents of the world, bar Antarctica. So we want to have a truly global company and not be more than a few hours flight time from any customer that we have in the world. And we did the math from that. So what's required? Well, we want to have sustainable teams of at least 10 to 12 people in each office for that to be a viable setup. And then sort of breaking that back to, okay, so what type of support organization do we have to have if we're going to have 12 times 8 offices? So that, then we need to be about 200, 250 people.
Right.
And then looking at what type of revenue do we need to have to support that? So the key element here is building that global community, and then the numbers are a consequence of that ambition.
Okay, cool. Is there anything you are looking for right now? Talent, investment, whatever?
Definitely not investment. So,
yeah. Imagine you saying, like, I'm ready for some VC capital.
Yeah, no. Just a kind shout out to all investors out there listening. Spend your time elsewhere. We're always looking for talent, enthusiastic, driven team members for all our different offices. You need to have a good sense of who you are, your own strengths and weaknesses. You need to have a strong drive. You want to achieve things. And then my belief is if you have that drive, you have that self-awareness, you can achieve just about anything. So those are the people that we're trying to bring on board.
Cool. And who should we bring on board here as the next guest on the Sassiest podcast in order for you to listen to a whole episode?
I've been struggling, and it's the problem with being a bootstrapped company is that there are very few role models to look at. I know Johnny at
Mentimeter.
Mentimeter, exactly. Sorry, he's on a fantastic journey.
Yeah.
But I do believe that they've taken on some funding here in the later stage.
They have.
Did we have him already in the podcast or just a few other Mentimeters?
Johnny has been in the podcast, yeah.
Yeah, and he's going to be on the Sassiest stage here in April. So.
Yeah. But you guys have some things in common because he also talked in the podcast, if I'm not remembering this, because it was like about 100 podcasts ago, about people and culture and how in their world compensation is tied to not just you bringing in the numbers or the dough. 50% of your compensation is linked to how collaborative and valuable of a team member you are. So some of the soft values.
Yeah. It's definitely something that we take into account, but we haven't made any sort of specific metrics or formulas for it. But everyone on the team has a flat salary. So there's no performance-based salaries. And that's, for us, a critical component in building this sense of family in the organization. And obviously, it's working well enough for a suitable growth.
All right.
So another one I'd like to hear more from is Victor Carlson, the CEO and founder of Televox. They've done an amazing growth journey and stayed mostly independent, I'd say. Their model is SaaS, but not true SaaS because it's also the phone subscription model, which is slightly different.
Right.
Yeah.
Very cool. This was really uplifting, Martin, to have you on the show here today. And we talk often about, you know, the processes and products and so on. Again, coming back to it comes down to people. So you heard it here first. If you want to be flying high, you know who to reach out to. see what I did there?
It's beautiful, Daniel. It's poetry.
Yeah. And let's talk about our next kickoff, Daniel. I really feel it's time to go to Iceland now. But All right. But Martin, always a pleasure. Always a pleasure, Martin. And see you soon again.
Thank you so much, Martin.
Thank you, guys. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.
So, Daniel, what's your takeaway from this episode?
Feel good story. I love people that take care of their people, and I love people that give an opportunity to younger professionals as well. Like, I love people that give an opportunity to everyone, but I feel like, you know, we've all been young, we've all been new at something, and really, if you think back at it, now I'm looking at myself, like,
did you get an opportunity as a young professional then?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. You know, like, you know, Mr. Nico Henschen was the CEO of a company called Across Systems many, many years ago. And I lived in Germany at that time. And he was trying to take this business. I was a sales rep in Germany, essentially. And he was trying to take this business to the U.S., had two attempts with hiring big shot Americans to set up the organization and so on there. And it was predominantly a revenue organization. I think it didn't work out as planned, or I know it didn't work out as planned. And then I still, you know, owe him for this. I don't know what really got into him, desperation, or he was just pissed. But at some point he was like, okay, it doesn't work with these people. I'm going to ask Daniel to fly over there. I was rather green, new. But that belief and trust in me, and of course they supported me, that really propelled my career. Like, you know, I was 25 years old and suddenly they were like, you're going to set up the US office. That was a big step for me. And I'm not going to say it was like smooth sailing. It was a little bit bumpy, but you know, that meant a lot to me. So if you're asking me what my big takeaway here is, that I believe that if you take care of your people, it's going to come back to you in many different ways. And Martin said here, like, you know, look at us, we're growing at 45%. That is, of course, one way. Another way is that, you know, we still have a war on talent. If you take care of your people, then that's going to spread out there. You know, they have friends, they have networks. It's going to be easier for you to attract people. And I also truly believe that, you know, we have talent at, you know, for some limited time. We just borrow talent, and at some point talent will always leave us. They will have new opportunities, new challenges. We just need to make the most of this. And even when talent leaves us, they will still hopefully talk good about us and point somebody else in our direction. So just take care of your people. It's going to pay you back in all kinds of ways. What about you, Thomas? What's your takeaway and what's your feeling after this?
I'll go with the test.
The test.
No, but it has with onboarding to do. I mean, they have this 2-week onboarding, right? And then they have the test. So it's not the, you know, the 90-day evaluation and so on, which becomes a little bit fussy.
Yeah.
It gives you a direct feedback, and I guess that they are prepared for that. They're going to have this test, so they need to sort of pay attention during the onboarding. And as Martin said, it's not about, you know, punishing someone or anything else. It's just, you know, get a very early indication of, you know, where you need to do some work in order to get this into a good experience, both for the company and for the employee. So I think it's good, refreshing.
Definitely. And I also think that the test is, I think he alluded to that a little bit, the test is also some kind of proof point or evidence as to how good did the educator, the lecturer, the person providing this information, how well did he or she do?
Yeah.
Because if everybody fails, well, maybe there was some issue with transferring the knowledge, you know?
Yeah. Maybe we should do a challenge, try to get hold of the test, and we can do it, you and me, just unprepared.
I don't know. What do you know about aviation?
Not that much.
We never asked him, like, does he have a pilot license, or like, does he... No, he's just a random guy that happens to be in this aviation industry.
Yeah, I don't know. But great episode. I think I enjoyed it a lot. Hope you guys that listened to it as well enjoyed it. And thank you for being with us this time. And I hope to see you at Sassiest. If you want to get involved in any of the networking group, if you have a CEO position or a C-level, VP-level position on a company that have got to 2 million euros in ARR, we have some really interesting groups that meet to share experiences on a regular basis. So head over to sassiest.com, go to community, you will find the pages there for the executive network, the CEO network. And then for everyone, we have the Slack community, and there is a lot of activity there now. You can share experiences in any area. So that's a good way to also start being more engaged in the Sassiest community.
Definitely. And I just realized here, like, you know, we've been talking about, you know, soft values, culture, people, and so on. If you're coming to Sassiest, whatever you do, if you enjoyed this episode, you need to check out the session with Robin Daniels.
Yeah.
He and his 200 and plus something colleagues all changed their titles to people success managers. He will talk about how the entire business and everybody in their business is about the success of the individual people.
Yeah.
You should join that session.
Yeah, he's great. LMS 365 is a very interesting company that we are following closely. And I think with that, we're done for today. So see you next time.
Take care.